Today I chat with Andy McGrath. He's the author of the book God is Dead, about the life of Frank Vandenbroek. Today in this conversation, we're going to explore Frank's prestigious talents. We're going to explore the pressures of fame, of which there were many, and his life beyond the peloton, the temptations that lay outside the bike. We're going to talk about that iconic victory in Liège-Bastogne-Liège and the profound challenges he faced. We're going to attempt to uncover the real story behind one of cycling's most enigmatic figures. Andy, welcome back to the Roadman Podcast.
Great to be here. Got my Ami de Roubaix mug here with all the sectors from Trouville down to the one in Roubaix, the little clinker section that's one star. So yeah, fantastic to be back.
We talked last time about Tom Simpson, the life and death of Tom Simpson, and it went down brilliant. If anyone hasn't checked that out, I'll link it below and you can go and check it out. But today we want to talk about an equally talented character and an equally tragic story in a lot of ways, Frank Vandenbroek. Why do you think he's such a compelling figure in the history of cycling?
Well, firstly, I think for a certain age of cycling fan, he is remarkable and unforgettable, because 30 years ago, we're talking like, we didn't have the Remcos, the Tadays, basically kids coming through from the junior ranks and starting to dominate. Like, it was the age of Roeminger, Museu, Indurain, good champions who didn't say that much to the press either, who didn't always ride with great panache. Like, we know that Indurain was a time trial monster. And then into the scene, you had Vandenbroek coming, turning pro. He was the youngest pro, I think, since World War II. He was 19, turned pro on his uncle's team. Jean-Luc Vandenbroek was also next to Eddie Merckx, which was a nickname that Vandenbroek was saddled with. And he had the charisma. He had the style. He had the panache on the bike. And he said, there's one quote from a Belgian commentator who said that in 5 minutes, Vandenbroek said more to him, gave him more than Museu and Van Petegem did in 5 years, you know. So, and this energy, this feeling like around him built, and it was the way he raced, the way he tackled races was unusual, exceptional. You know, the way that he won Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which is his kind of the race he's remembered most for, his only monument win. He did it like Muhammad Ali did it. He said where he would attack days beforehand. And he did that. You know, he went up the road and he beat everyone comfortably. It was kind of Pogacar-esque, you know. We can make that comparison now. But it just didn't happen then.
We often hear people tagged with the next Eddie Merckx. We've heard it time and time again. But what has to happen in the early career for that to be attributed to a rider? Like, what was Vandenbroek's early years like? How dominant was he at underage, junior, and U23 categories to get that moniker?
But number one, you've got to be Belgian to be saddled with that with that pressure. Like, I've, you know, writing that book, and the more I've been in the cycling world, the more I've realized it's a ridiculous nickname, and probably no poor Belgian teenager should be called the next Eddy Merckx, because no one will be the next Eddy Merckx. Cycling has changed. You'll never win 500 races in your life.
But tempo, gotcha.
Well, I was listening to a different podcast this morning, and they said that Pogacar's referred to by Eddy Merckx's family as Little Eddie, you know, which is a funny kind of connection. You know, he'll win probably 200, which is some going for a non-sprinter. But anyway, yeah. Sorry, back to the question. Junior U23, he was exceptional. And this is the thing, Vandenbroek wasn't much of a sprinter. He was okay. Like, he had a decent kick. So, but he would win these 60K, 50K, 70K races as a teenager by 1 minute, 2 minutes, you know. There was one, I think one junior year, he won something like 49% of all the races he started. Half, basically. Unreal. Like, that's pretty unreal. He was kind of helped that he was in the cycling dynasty. His uncle Jean-Luc had been the next Merckx, had raced against Merckx, had beaten Merckx actually when he was young. Didn't quite live up to it like no one ever does. His father had briefly been a pro, but he'd had to jack it all in just when he was like about to really start racing, because his father died and he had to become the parental guardian to his younger brothers. So there was possibly an element of his dad vicariously living out his dream through Frank. And his dad went on to become a mechanic for Lotto and various other teams too. Sean Kelly's team, for example. So Frank Van Rupp grew up in this cycling environment. He was immersed in it. You know, the riders would stop off at the bar that his parents owned, often sleep there, you know, drink there, chat there. And he was always getting the best kit, you know, as you would expect, you know, his dad doing him a solid, you know, giving him the latest stuff. But he had the talent and the application. He adored cycling. Now, that's what you need, isn't it? Like from teenage days when you're dreaming, you know, that's the fundamentals. And he had exceptional talent. So, and in Belgium, you've been there, right? Like every town has their hero, you know. It could be the smallest name rider, but if you're pro, you're beloved. And you had these people lifting him up. You had the Belgian media looking for the next Merckx. Because when you think about it, like, it hadn't been that long since Merckx retired when Van der Broek came through. It had been about 15, yeah. 16 years, which isn't, like, think back to, we're talking 2010, aren't we? That doesn't feel so distant. And really, it had fallen into disrepair compared to the great period they had in the 70s and 60s and even early 80s. So they were clinging on.
If you think about cycling and the now, and if you were a parent with a child going into cycling now, yeah, sure, you're worried about the obvious dangers of crashes and burnout and just your child being away from home. But Frank went pro in 1994. You know, we could debate all day about the most toxic year to turn pro, but 94 was one of the most toxic years that you could ever turn professional in the history of cycling. It was a high octane environment, as described by some of the participants in it, like Tyler Hamilton and George Hincapie. It must have been terrifying for a parent to let a child loose into that environment. And his dad would have had a bit of knowledge as to what was going on in cycling in that period.
Yeah, he turned pro like into the Wild West, like into like one pro in the 90s said to me, it was, you know, like discovering the nuclear bomb. That's when he turned pro. EPO.
Oppenheimer. We're talking about,
what's that?
The Oppenheimer moment. Yeah.
Great film. I kind of prefer Barbie, but they're both great. but no, like EPO was, youth became rampant, you know. We know from people like Tyler and other people you've interviewed that it was an appalling time for a young person, older pro to be in, because it was kind of, they came to feel that if you didn't take these drugs, not just EPO, sometimes human growth hormones, steroids, other things, if you didn't take them, you would be lost or in the back group. And if you did that for 1 year or for 2 years, everything you've worked for since your childhood is gone, because you won't get like another contract. As for his parents, I would be surprised if they were under huge illusions as to what was going on. His dad certainly was in this world, like he'd been in cycling since the early 70s. He'd been a team mechanic. I can't speak for him, but he wouldn't have been shocked. He may have had some knowledge of what was going on for sure. But I know that most parents, certainly nowadays, would not want their children turning pro in that era, and certainly wouldn't want their children now putting a needle in their arm or transfusing blood or any of the sinister, ghoulish stuff that has gone on in the past.
When you chat to guys from that era, there's this period after they become aware of performance-enhancing drugs, but before they decide to cross the line and take performance-enhancing drugs. And often they wrestle internally with this moral dilemma. Should I stay on the side of good and walk away from my dreams and aspirations, or should I cross to the side of evil and continue this somewhat double life where the public are unaware, but privately a lot of your friends know what's going on? Was there a sense that he wrestled with his consciousness in those moments?
It's of me to say, like, but I think cycling in the 90s was a moral maze. So you describe it as evil, but they certainly, people who were cheating did not see it then as cheating. Like, they saw it as just keeping up appearances, you know, like, and there was no real limit. Like, the UCI set a hematocrit limit of 50%, but that was, the tests were kind of like sporadic, and there were things you could do to easily get your level under it, that it was. And then if you were over, I think you got banned for 2 weeks or the next race. Like, that's hardly a deterrent for speeding, is it? Like, if that's a kind of deterrent, then everyone's going to be doing 120 miles an hour, aren't they? Which is kind of generalizing what happened in the, like, in the 90s. But morally, he wanted to win so badly. He had that intense desire in whatever sport he did. So Van der Broek was a junior cross-country champion in Belgium before he really got into cycling. He was good at that.
Unreal.
He picked up darts. He was great at that. He could have been Luke Littler, you know, the British teenager, smashing it now. Probably
I
football.
Go to see him tonight.
Yeah. Oh, love darts. Absolutely adore it. You know, fantastic sport. Very different to cycling. Not quite so physical, you know. But so in terms of wrestling with conscience, I didn't get a huge sense of that. But there was definitely that moment, like with later on when he was dabbling in sleeping pills, he became addicted to them. I did get a sense then of this was a turning point in his life. You know, this was a real, possibly more significant and worse for him than performance-enhancing drugs. Taking that from his then teammate, Philip Gomor, he tracked that point to being where he started to go from paradise to hell, basically.
I definitely want to jump into that, but let's put a pin in that for 1 second before we come back to it, because I want to understand a little bit more the cultural context of how big he was in Belgium at the time before we get to understand the pressures and strains that might have drove him to that recreational drug use. The name of your book, which is amazing, and we'll link it below, it's God is Dead. He's picked up this nickname of God. That's an insane nickname to have. Like, the attention that goes with that. The closest we probably get now is the attention that goes on Remco in Belgium. Do you see similarities between the level of attention that Remco gets and the level of attention that Van den Broek got? Or are they incomparable? Hey, Roadman, excuse the short interruption. I love riding the bike, but on account of being so busy with the podcast at the moment, I'm now what's called a time-crunched rider. I never thought I'd see the day. But I have a tool. I'm using Wattbike to keep myself sharp and on point with specific sessions to maximize that available training time. I have a Wattbike Atom right here in the recording studio beside me. And when I have an hour in between interviews, I jump on. It's removing all the friction points for me. There's no more 10-minute setup, unfolding legs, banging my knees off stuff, getting my hands dirty, the usual connection issues. It just works every single time. The Atom's perfect for virtual racing as well because it has crisp gear changes, it has 1% accuracy, and it has max gradient capability of up to 25%. If you're looking for an indoor trainer, I honestly couldn't recommend this any higher. I've been using a Wattbike since 2013. Honestly, it's the last indoor trainer that you're ever going to need. If you head on over to wattbike.com now and use code ROADMAN10, that's ROADMEN10, and that's going to get you 10% off your Wattbike.
Absolutely do, yeah. In fact, when I was writing this book and researching it, I think it was 2018, 2019, 2020, and Remco was just on the rise, and some people were in the interviews were making direct comparisons. Like, they were saying, Remco needs to read this book, basically to see what the pitfalls are of early success and fame and to avoid those problems. So especially back then, there were direct comparisons. Remco was just like Van den Broek, and he has that charisma. He has that ridiculous talent, that panache, you know, to win solo on a 60K breakaway. That's just like what Van den Broek used to do, sometimes probably more than that. And he has the same pressure, because, you know, that God nickname, it comes from this religious passion that the Belgians have for the national sport that you basically don't get anywhere else. They called him God because, you know, they worship cycling too, not just Vandenberg for his style and his grace and his achievements. But, you know, what the title and the book's trying to get at a bit is that no human being, no mortal should be made into a god, like a deity, because they have even further to fall when they inevitably don't win or they disappoint. And it's a very dangerous thing when someone's built up, especially at a very young age, because Vandenberg was just a boy, really, when he turned pro. Remco, too, like, they're fast-tracked into this adult complex world and they're not ready for it in some ways.
And it's also an impossibility to live up to the expectations, because the best you can ever do, even with unbelievably successful career, is to match the expectations. And anything short of matching the expectations then gets labeled as a flop.
That's the thing. I've often thought it's actually better to, you know, if I was a world tour rider, which anyone who's seen me on a bike can say I have definitely never been near. If I was, I would want to be like Christoph, the Norwegian on Uno X, who came up, you know, no one saw him for 4 or 5 years really with BMC, but he's had a great career. He's won Flanders, he's won Tour de France stages, he's won loads of races, but he didn't have to deal with any pressure or really any interview requests or any of that for years. Whereas people like Damian Okunigo, like going back 20 years to my adolescence, or you know, Remco. Yeah, great guy, great racer. But when everything comes first, you know, in the first 5 years of your pro career, you set yourself such a standard and you set everyone else that standard that they expect it. Like, so it's kind of nice to see people doing it different ways in modern cycling now. Like, I really want to say to young cyclists, teenagers, ones in the first few years of their World Tour career, it shouldn't have to be the Remco way. That isn't the only route to success. Like, of course, everyone would love to be winning World Tour races age 20, age 21, 19. But realistically, the prime for an athlete is still 28, 29, like physically. And psychologically, you know, you need to build up that capacity for what's facing you, not just the races, but everything around that, you know. Everything around that is really important for what happened to Vandenbroek in his life. Like, the bike was like a refuge for him. He was safe there. It was everything else around it that became more and more problematic.
So what's the Belgian media like? Obviously, I'm in Ireland and you spend a chunk of your time in the UK, and we get a lot of the English tabloid papers. And football is the religion in the UK. And we see every 4 years the English tabloids building the English national team up, and they love to build them up, but it's so toxic on the way back down. We see even national heroes like Beckham, and they're running front page stories of effigies of Beckham burning after he got sent off for kicking Simone in the World Cup quarter or semi-final against Argentina. Is the Belgian press the same sort of ideology, where it's almost, you know, over complimentary on the way up, but then the blades are out on the way back down?
I think to a certain extent, that's all media, like, regardless of nationality. Like, certainly, especially now, in this era of clickbait and trying to get people's attention. Back in the day, you know, 15, 20 years ago, but when Vandenbroek was still racing, It was more of a goldfish bowl, and that's not a good thing. You know, you have your big newspapers there, Het Nieuwsblad, Het Laatste Nieuws, De Morgen, etc. And at his height, there were basically Vandenbroek correspondents. There were people whose job was to find out, where is he? What is he doing? Find him, search for him. You know, there were paparazzi with long lenses. When he was going through really difficult times, you know, mental health crises, who were staking outside his house, you know, with their cameras. Like, it was a funny period. We're talking really like late 90s, early noughties, you know, to the point I kind of went into it, like, in the book, that Britney Spears gets a mention in a cycling book. Because around the same time, you know, she shaved her head and she was hounded by the media. And looking back, it was pretty toxic. Like, this is pre-social media. Very toxic, not very feminist at all. But it wasn't good for him. Like, well, like in one sense, it was good for him because he was what the French call like a bon client, like a good client. And he gave the media so much. He always gave them great quotes. They would keep coming back to him and his profile raised, his salary raised, vaguely related to that, but not really. But, you know, endorsements raised, that's good. But as you say, on the way back down, because Van den Broek made a lot of kind of mistakes and lost races, that's not on the media, but they will, you know, ruthlessly report that just as relentlessly as they wrote stuff about him on the way up. So partially it's kind of the way things are, but partially, certainly going back to the question, like the Belgian media, when they sent several journalists out to, I think it was Remco's first bike race ever, Tour de Saint-Louis 4 or 5 years ago, I remember thinking, what are you doing? Like, his first race, like, that's enough pressure. He's just trying to fit in, like, give the lad a break.
Yeah.
But anyway, like, I've got lots of good friends and colleagues in, like, in the Belgian media. It's only grown, you know, in the 25 years, you know, I think Remco can handle it. He's learned to handle it.
What do you think was the catalyst for the mental health difficulties? Because when I look at the story, at some point, the attention is welcomed. He's partying. He's starting to, you know, take some recreational drugs. Life is good. He's living in that sort of border area where he can straddle between French worlds and Belgian worlds. He's this charismatic, popular character. But at some point where I can't put my finger on it, it starts to get in on him privately and he gets a little bit more darker in his thoughts. Do you have any insights into when that turning point was?
Well, I think it was stemmed partly, you know, weeks after he won Liège-Bastogne-Liège in 1999, he was taken into a police cell in Paris, basically because he was caught up in this sting operation of his advisor, Dr. Mabuse, was his nickname, Bernard Sainz, who had been helping him with homeopathic remedies, shall we say. But also, you know, a kind of confidence helper. He really was kind of, Frank had a tricky relationship with his dad and they fell out at times. And Sainz was at times like the father he never had. I'm certainly steeped in cycling history. But anyway, this monument winner ended up in this kind of police cell. And from that, he then had to give press conferences where he was a bad guy. And later he was photographed in handcuffs at court, which should never have happened. Like there was a kind of breach of security, long story short. So basically you go from this god to people in your hometown giving you suspicious glances and you're the fallen anti-hero, not even fallen hero. And he struggled with that. Like I think many people would. That didn't help his mental state, you know, being the pariah. Because another thing explored in the book is, you know, broadly speaking, he's doing this to be loved. I personally think most people want to be loved in life. Bike races, winning, succeeding, it's just a way to find that love that he maybe didn't quite get from his father. Now he's getting the opposite. Then you have the sleeping pill problem that starts in the winter of 1998. It's just reading it back at the books here, just reading some of the stuff, it's just mental. Like these are young people, but mixing loads of sleeping pills with alcohol, that's no party. Like that's, you know, they pass out, they do things, they don't remember. It's nightmarish. Like, I can't believe that happened, but that was cycling in the late 90s. And he became addicted to that feeling. And he became addicted to certain things, later cocaine too. So I could see his mental health starting to spiral, partly from this problem, partly from, you know, going into drugs as a kind of, or sleeping pills as a kind of refuge, because his reality in the mid-90s became so unpalatable. And partly the speed of it too. Like when you go from God to below the floor in the space of a month, like we can't really relate to that, but it must have been so hard. And that's where the problem started. Even though he won two world status later that year, crazily.
Yeah, because we look at that period, and if you're just straight out looking at his palmarès, 98, he wins Paris-Nice, 99, wins Liège in, you know, spectacular fashion. You're expecting him to kick on from there. You're expecting the palmarès to just be getting started from there. But in all honesty, they were probably his crowning achievements. Rob, man, I know how serious you take your goal setting, whether they're fitness or life-related goals. If you're looking for a powerful ally to support you on this journey, look no further than Huel. Huel has become my secret weapon for when I don't have time to prepare a balanced meal. It ensures I get the nutrition I need without sacrificing time or taste. Plus, it stops me from reaching for that takeaway menu. I always throw a bottle into my backpack when I'm heading into the city to work, and it stops me eating junk convenience foods, snacking on croissants and bars of chocolate, because I know they don't support my training goals. It's a handy, nutritious meal on the go, and it's got over 22 grams of protein. Huel is perfect for athletes that don't have time to cook or prepare food before a training session. It's convenient, nutritious fuel at your fingertips, ensuring you hit your daily fueling needs for that session. Huel Ready to Drink has 26 essential vitamins and minerals in every single bottle. You're getting a whopping 175 health benefits. Plus, it's made from natural ingredients like tapioca, sunflower seed, coconut, and more. The best part? It's the flavors. There's 8 crazy, beautiful flavors. Iced coffee is what's in my backpack right at the moment. You can get Huel directly to your home. All you got to do is head on over to the Huel website, huel.com/roadman.
That's right. Like, in hindsight, Liège was the beginning of the end, or what happened afterwards. But there was always this fragility that we don't see so much now. Like, behind the scenes, when he won Paris-Nice, the day before the last stage, he said he wanted to quit the race, having won 2 or 3 stages in the leader's jersey. Like, his, I think it was his masseur, his kinesiologist, told me that he was like Mike Tyson before a bike race. He was filled with so much doubt beforehand. He was in tears. Then he got into the race and he'd destroy everyone, you know, like it. And he had this vulnerability the whole time, on the bike, off the bike. You never knew which Frank van den Broek you would get. So even winning Paris-Nice, being this champion, 24 hours before, he was ready to quit. Like, there was always a story like this with van den Broek. I've almost never experienced this with any other cyclist, which it wasn't easy writing the book, but it made life easier because things were either full gas or on the brakes for long. There was nothing in the middle, seemingly. That must have been very hard to live, you know, to experience.
In the post-Team Sky era, we've added, you know, more staff into a cycling team, and we've amazing minds now, like Dr. Steve Peters, who was largely, you know, involved in British Cycle, and Bradley Wiggins keeping him on the rails for that period where he was so successful. Do you think having a character like that, a sports psychologist, Steve Peters, does that change the trajectory of his career? Obviously, we're wildly speculating, but, you know, from your insight, do you think that was a missing component for him?
I think at first it was, you know, we're talking about cycling 30, 40 years ago when you look back, mental health, that word wasn't a thing, was it, really, in professional sport? And unfortunately, going to see a psychologist or a psychotherapist back then was, you know, as shameful as holding on the team car going up the Mur de Gerardsbergen. Like, it wasn't spoken about if it was done, you know, by these champions. And that could have helped van den Broek. But the thing is that I think it was 2000, or when was it? Maybe 2003, he started seeing Jeff Brouwers, who became his trusted confidant, his psychotherapist, who really helped him, who tried to help him, you know, who actually got too close to him, was his reasoning to me, that he wanted to change him. He thought he could change him because he saw his brilliance, you know. He saw that Vandenbroek was in the first percentile for intelligence, for example, you know, just based on, not based on sport. And that helped to keep him alive for longer.
It's a tragic story, and it gets me thinking, why do we seem to over-index and produce more of these flawed heroes in cycling than other sports? There's just so many, especially from that era as well. That's, you know, the Benesto climber, his name escapes me, died of a drug overdose. Pantani, drug overdose.
Jose Maria Jimenez.
It's so tragic.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. It's so tragic.
I think there's a lot of reasons, you know. Partly it's nature and partly nurture, like the culture of cycling at that time. You have lots of these cyclists who are used to, you know, using recreational drugs, like it's eating candy, like eating sweets. And that, you know, provides a really negative consequence for off the bike, because they're looking for that high, they're looking for that rush. And that makes it easier to go on to recreational drugs, which is kind of what happened with Pantani, Jimenez, and Vandenbroek. And there was a lack of duty of care, really. Like that word wasn't really used in pro sport. You know, team managers should have a responsibility and accountability to their riders. Interestingly, Patrick Lefebvre was his team manager then, and we saw what he said about Julian Alaphilippe several months ago, that he's drinking too much. You know, I thought that was pretty toxic, pretty reprehensible, very Patrick Lefebvre. But I think there's no place in sport for that kind of thing. Like, imagine if your boss said that publicly about you. What does that do for your confidence? What does that do for your mindset when you're trying? When is he trying to motivate Alaphilippe? Like, that's a hell of a way of, you know, doing it. But anyway, so partly nurture, and then there's a little bit of something inside these people. You know, maybe it's a self-destructive trait. Maybe, I don't think it's fragility or weakness. It'd be very harsh to say that. But it taps into something. You know, Vandenbroek wants to be loved, and he always felt, the tragedy was he felt alone even when he was surrounded by people that loved him. And the longer his life went on, the more he felt that he was going nowhere, you know. So it's a case of different individuals, but it's also, you know, that culture was absolutely rotten, and I'm really glad that pro cycling has moved past that nuclear toxic burned, you know, generation. And that's the thing. Like, I also want to say there were pros then who are suffering in silence now. You know, a few of them have illnesses possibly related to what they were taking. Some of them, you know, one of them who I won't name was suicidal with me weeks later on the phone. So even I didn't know what kind of world I was going into. I didn't expect that pain, that torture, 25 years later, that, you know. So I have a lot of kind of empathy, you know, and that's as far as I went to it. Like, you have to be objective when you're writing a biography. But you have to be sympathetic too to the pain and suffering that was going on.
Well, it's almost like post-traumatic stress disorder still kicked in. How much do we know about his final days, and how did he ultimately pass away?
So, you know, Frank kept on being a pro to his final months, but he was signing for smaller teams for smaller salaries, and he did win a very small race in 2009, but it was clear that his career was petering out and his life was fading away. He went to Senegal on holiday in, I think it was October 2009, with a much younger teammate. And it transpired later that he'd asked about 10, 12 people, just the ones that I interviewed, to come with him to Africa, but they couldn't come. So he lighted on this this younger friend who was possibly more impressionable than, say, his agent, Paul De Gator, or Patrick Lefevre, or his mum, he asked, you know. And anyway, what happened in, it's still a bit of a mystery, but what happened in Senegal basically was the last person who saw him alive was a prostitute. They had been in a nightclub. They went back to a hotel. And, you know, Frank had been drinking. He went back to his room. And then he was found dead the next day.
Rob, man, I've got something exciting to share with you. It's been making a huge difference in my performance of late, especially when it comes to my sleep. Allow me to introduce you to Pillar. We're probably all familiar with the importance of electrolytes and carbohydrates in our race preparation. Pillar is taking a slightly different route. It's focusing on something called micronutrition, ensuring you're ready to perform even before you ever hit the start line. It's all about promoting a good night's sleep, facilitating effective recovery, and replenishing those crucial micronutrients so you can perform your best. Over the past month, I've been running a little experiment. I've been incorporating Pillar's triple magnesium supplement into my routine. I take it 30 minutes before bed every night, and I've seen a remarkable improvement in my sleep quality and my HRV. I'm tracking this every single night using my Whoop, and the results are there in black and white. I wake up feeling refreshed, having had a deep restorative sleep, and I'm ready to take on work, take on training, or whatever life throws at me the next day. But I want you to do something. Don't take my word for this. Let the data from your fitness tracker tell you the story. If you're ready to elevate your performance and elevate your sleep quality like me, why not give Pillar a try? Head on over to pillarperformance.shop and use the code ROADMAN on your local website to get 15% off your first order. If you're listening in the US, you can head on over to thefeed.com/pillar and use the code ROADMAN for the same 15% off your first order.
The family refused a toxicology report. They just wanted their son back. You know, that in a way they suffered enough, is my reading of it. So it isn't definitive what happened. You know, there's, I really go into it like in the book. It's kind of like a mystery, but was it suicide? There are some elements that would suggest that. His psychologist, he doesn't say that, but he hints at that. Was it just a kind of accident? You know, that there had been people, tourists that go to Senegal who had their drink spiked, who also died, you know, that year. Was it just a horrendous accident? Was it natural causes? Also possible, you know. So long story short, it's not clear, but there's lots of theories.
What do you think is his legacy? Is it a race? Is it a moment? Or is it a cautionary tale?
Sorry, I was just going to say, not officially clear, but I know what I think happened. I think it's a cautionary tale. Like, no one wants a pro cyclist to die like that, like to die in his prime, basically. I think it's easy to think of Van den Broek as yesterday's man. You know, yes, his finest races were in the last century, but he was also racing with people like Chris Froome and Thomas De Gendt. You know, he's not so long ago. That generation is not so distant. So we have to be careful. Like, I also think, you know, duty of care, psychology has stepped up, but it's still something to be worked on. In pro sport, but also in pro cycling, you know, there's lots of, you know, traditionalists out there running teams or you know, DSs, which isn't ideal, you know, if they have. But yeah, I think it's cautionary. It partly belongs to a certain era, but it partly, you know, there are lessons to be learned. And there are things that could have been different for Van den Broek. You know, people said to me, if he'd stayed at Mapei with Lefevre, he'd have been okay. If he'd quit cycling and became a pundit or a wine expert, because he loved wine, he'd have been okay, you know. And it's sad hearing those ifs. Like, basically, I would be happy never writing another book like that, because nothing like this ever happens to a pro cyclist. That's the aim, isn't it? You know, but I also think for better or for worse, we sports fans, cycling fans, we're drawn to people who exceed their limits and do things that we would never countenance doing, would never consider doing. Maybe it's a vicarious thing, but certainly reading Vandenbroek, his book, you know, writing it, you realize he had a hell of a life. Incredible highs, incredible lows. But we're attracted to pushing the limits.
And I think I speak for all cycling fans when I just say thanks for your work. It's why we're so attracted to cycling. It's the color, the texture, the history of cycling. It's what makes it special and what makes it beautiful. And you're preserving and you're bringing back to life some of the brightest and some of the darkest moments from the past that maybe otherwise get lost. So thanks very much for taking the time to chat today. But, you know, broader than that, thank you so much for taking the time to thoroughly research these books and shine a light on the heroes of our sport.
Yeah, I would say it's my pleasure. Also, we talked about some dark things today, and there are some dark things, certainly in Vandenbroek's story, but there's a lot of, you know, light and levity. You know, he was a great impressionist, like a bit like Bradley Wiggins. He had so much fun and he gave so much to people. You know, sometimes he would buy watches for his teammates. And there are a lot of, you know, endearing, lovable, funny stories in the book, even though it might not sound that, you know, from listening to the last half an hour. But yeah, unfortunately, as you put it very well, it's really as light and dark with Vandenbroek and cycling in that era sometimes.
Andy, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.